Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnen? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rob Young. On the programme today, as the number of people who've died attending the Hajj continues to rise, we look at the business of the annual pilgrimage and ask why some visitors are allowed access to air-conditioned rooms and others are not, even as temperatures soar above 50 degrees. We'll also hear why members of the UK's richest family have been on trial in Switzerland, accused of exploitation and human trafficking. And the families and businesses in the United States feeling the pain of higher interest rates.
I'm constantly trying to figure out ways to budget and prioritise and come up with more money. And it's just tough.
Remember, you can always email us at any time on the stories we're covering on the programme. The address is world.business@bbc.co.uk. Well, we start the programme in the Middle East, where many hundreds of pilgrims have died at the annual Hajj in Saudi Arabia. The temperature in Mecca has risen to over 50 degrees Celsius in recent days, and the number of pilgrims who've died is reported to be over 1,000. According to some reports, those who have not officially registered as pilgrims are the most vulnerable because they don't have access to the cooling facilities like air-conditioned rooms, which are provided by the Saudi authorities. Well, earlier the BBC spoke to one pilgrim who's been there and wanted to remain anonymous.
It was so poorly managed, and we have seen that people were suffocating over there, people were dying over there, but they were so helpless. At different points, we were not viewing any kind of help by administration in the shape of first aid or anything else. I have seen more than 7 to 8 people who were getting unconscious. There were people, there were dead bodies on the road, but they were not picking up them. People were telling us that when they were calling 911 for help, there was no response from them. And if ambulance is little far over there, they are delaying to pick up the dead bodies.
Shocking account there from one eyewitness. Well, the authorities in Jordan have said that they have detained several tour company owners who facilitated the unofficial travel of Muslim pilgrims to Saudi Arabia. Egypt has said it will investigate firms accused of doing the same. Well, the price of the official tours has been increasing in recent years, and the event earns Saudi Arabia billions of dollars in revenue, and that is growing year by year. Professor Joseph Cheer from Western Sydney University in Australia has written a book about religious tourism. I've been talking to him about the industry and first about the deaths at the Hajj this year.
They're talking, you know, really huge numbers. In 2019, there were 17.3 million international tourists to Saudi Arabia, and most of them would have been pilgrims because Saudi Arabia hadn't opened up yet. Today, I would say it would be more than double that. There's a push that's come about because during COVID, none of this was able to really take place. And now there's a whole, you know, backlog of pilgrims who want to make this once-in-a-lifetime journey to Mecca. Particularly, they're talking about a lot of older pilgrims attending Hajj and Umrah. And, you know, when you combine age and frailty and the conditions that they're likely to experience, it's no surprise that tragedy of this size has taken place.
Do you think it's possible that Saudi Arabia would be able to cope with an even greater number of pilgrims than have been there this year and last year?
I think they can, but not without difficulty. When we have people showing up at destinations independently, it's very difficult for authorities to put a handle on what they can and can't do, unless, you know, they move to other means. For example, there's talk about virtual reality pilgrimages, right? Can people go on a pilgrimage and be at home in their living room, but watching a live stream of it? But if we think about the motivations behind why someone goes on a pilgrimage, it's to be there, to feel, to touch, to hear, to smell. You know, in the old days, a pilgrimage was about suffering. And I think, you know, the heat, the scale, the difficulties, I'm not sure it will deter people, because it harkens back to the idea of going on a pilgrimage.
And in the aftermath of this large number of deaths at the Hajj, we've had the Egyptian Prime Minister's office say they're investigating tour companies who arranged trips of pilgrims to Saudi Arabia. Do you think that kind of action might dissuade companies from selling pilgrimage tours outside of the official channels?
No, not at all. I think, you know, across the region, domestic tourism is a huge industry, right? We talk here now, we're talking about people from outside of the region going to Saudi Arabia for the Hajj. But really, you know, there are a lot of people who travel to it and are domestic tourists or expatriates, you know, making their own way across. What will make a difference is the Saudi authorities reflecting on how this has happened. But if the scale is only going to intensify, they will need to move very quickly and implement a range of mechanisms. But of course, you can build as many hotels as you want. Inevitably, all of these pilgrims will converge onto the same, roughly the same small area, right? How do you plan for sustainable religious tourism is the thing that I write about with my colleagues. You know, we've gone from, you know, we talk about mass tourism generally, and we see this manifested in over tourism in popular places around the world. Now what we're seeing is mass religious tourism.
Professor Joseph Cheer there on the line from Australia. Now, Africa imports 99% of the vaccines that it uses, and often leaders complain at an exorbitant cost. Well, the African Union wants the continent to produce 60% of its own vaccines by the end of the next decade. In an attempt to do that, a new $1.2 billion programme has been launched. The money will largely be provided by European nations. Now, many parts of Africa have recently been tackling deadly outbreaks of cholera, but only one company in the world, based in South Korea, makes the oral vaccine that people need. On the line now is Dr. John Nkengasong. He's the former director of the Africa Centre for Disease Control and is now the United States Global AIDS Coordinator. He's on the line from the US. Welcome to the programme. Just first of all, and briefly, why does Africa, in your view, need to produce its own vaccines?
Africa needs to produce its own vaccines because we see this from the United States perspective as part of the global health security architecture, with the recognition that a disease threat anywhere in the world is a disease threat everywhere in the world. We saw that during COVID, and enabling Africa, a continent of 1.4 billion people, to produce vaccines is part of the collective health security. So we really applaud the African Union and Gavi for their vision in establishing the African Vaccine Manufacturing Accelerator.
And so when we look at this initiative that you just mentioned there, we're talking about using this money to persuade the big global pharmaceutical companies to open production plans on the African continent.
Absolutely. It has to be deal with that ecosystem where the money hopefully is used in enabling the market, is used in supporting regulatory processes, is used in building, supporting R&D, research and development in that same ecosystem, so that vaccine manufacturing is looked at in Africa from an end-to-end, so that the continent can actually be self-sufficient in producing vaccines from the development to the filling and actually rolling out vaccination to in the arms. I think we've always said that vaccines without vaccination is no vaccine. So I think this is really a great opportunity The United States government, in the same meeting, has pledged $1.5 billion commitment of working with Congress to avail this over the next 5 years, and is part of our ongoing support for Gavi, which is really has been a tremendous, probably heard, life-saving initiative, saving over 8 million lives over the last 25 years, and really vaccinating a whole host of children. So we are extremely excited with this new initiative for Africa, and looking forward to a continuous partnership with the African Union and Africa CDC.
Okay, what do you think they would be needed to take this a step further, so that you have African-owned pharmaceutical companies producing vaccines in Africa for Africans?
It requires partnerships. I mean, nothing in the space of global health is done in isolation. We have seen the power of partnership before COVID, during the COVID, and after COVID. I think we also require that Africans take the lead in developing this. We are very encouraged to see that we already have on the continent vaccine manufacturing efforts going on in Senegal, in South Africa, in Rwanda, in Morocco, and other places. These initiatives were not there before COVID. So this is very, very encouraging. So we hope that through the different partnerships, we'll continue to, not just with the U.S. government, but with the private sector, with the Europeans and others, we'll continue to work with Africans to put them on the lead to drive this exercise.
Thanks very much indeed. That's Dr. John Nkengasong there, who's the United States Global AIDS Coordinator.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Kinderleicht ist der Alltag, wenn wir einen zuverlässigen Partner wie DM Drogeriemarkt an unserer Seite haben. DM versteht, was Familien brauchen und bietet mit einem sorgfältig ausgewählten Sortiment alles, was uns Freude bereitet. Und achtet gerade bei DM-Markenprodukten auf Qualität zu einem günstigen Preis. Und auch wie wir einkaufen ist wichtig. Deshalb bietet DM euch Einkaufsmöglichkeiten und Lieferservices, die optimal in euer Leben passen. Mehr Infos findet ihr auf dm.de/familien.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, in Switzerland, members of the UK's richest family have been on trial, accused of exploitation and human trafficking. The Hinduja family, which is worth an estimated $47 billion, have faced allegations they spent more money caring for their dog than they did for their servants. Well, the family own a villa in a wealthy neighbourhood of Geneva, and the charges against them all relate to their practice of importing servants from India to look after their children and household. Well, earlier on, I spoke to the BBC's Imogen Folkes, who's in Geneva, and she told me more about the background to the case.
Well, what this trial is about is that some of the servants of this very wealthy Hinduja family, in fact, Britain's wealthiest family, took a case to court saying that they had not been paid and to a certain extent had been mistreated, centering around this not being paid. Now, in the course of that investigation and trial, the other things came out, allegations that they were not allowed to leave the house, that they had been brought in from India, but then when they arrived in Geneva, their passports removed. So there are two separate things going on here. With the non-payment, it appears that the complainants and the Hinduja family reached a financial settlement, what they did a week ago. We don't know how much. It's an undisclosed sum, rumoured to be very large. And the complainants have now withdrawn their case. But the Geneva prosecutor is continuing because of this really quite serious allegation of taking someone's passports away, basically bringing them in from another country to work, then apparently not paying them or paying them very little and denying them any freedom of movement, taking their passports away. That, under Swiss law, could fall under the criminal offence of people trafficking, and that is why the prosecutor has taken it further.
Right, so there's this financial settlement reached for the exploitation charge, but we're still waiting to learn what might happen in relation to the trafficking charge. How did the Hinduja family respond to the various allegations made against them?
Well, their defence lawyers have been very keen to point out that although the cash paid to these workers does appear to be very, very low, the claim is that they were getting all sorts of other things, like food, like accommodation, that the allegations of long hours, sometimes 18 to 20 hours a day, was not really an accurate reflection of what they were doing, because they said, you know, if you sit down with the Hinduja family children to watch a movie with them, that's not really work. We have heard of these cases before. Even, for example, the former dictator of Libya, Gaddafi, his son was arrested by, and his wife were arrested by Geneva police, it's a good 10 years ago now, for allegedly mistreating their servants. The case was eventually dropped. But what I would say is it's a bit of an open secret that inside these villas in Geneva and inside some of these five-star hotels, some people are working very hard but being treated very badly.
The BBC's Imogen Folks there in Geneva. Right, let's head to the United States now, where businesses and consumers started the year hoping that interest rates would be cut this summer. The cost of borrowing, which was close to zero at the beginning of 2022, now stands at about 5.25%. America's central bank, the Federal Reserve, had increased rates to try to bring the cost of living crisis in the United States to an end. Prices, you may remember, in stores and online had been soaring by their fastest pace for several decades. Now, the rate of price rises has slowed dramatically, but not enough to persuade the central bank to cut rates yet. And that is proving painful for many families and could potentially prove politically costly for President Biden's re-election chances, as Michelle Fleury now reports from the swing state of Pennsylvania.
Hello.
On the outskirts of Philadelphia, Stacey Ellis tells me she's had it with rising prices.
Inflation has raised my stress level. I'm constantly trying to figure out ways to budget and prioritize and come up with more money. And it's just tough. Like, it's a Debbie Downer. Kills your spirit a little.
Moon, moon, moon. This is Moona. My grandkid, I call her.
A single mum working two jobs while going to school, she still can't make ends meet.
I make too much to receive any sort of benefits or any sort of assistance from the state, but I don't make enough to be able to survive.
Sitting on her stoop, we run through Stacey's expenses.
What is the most expensive thing?
Rent, transportation, groceries. Those are the top three most expensive things. I live by a budget. I budget, 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 and I prioritize.
Prices are slowly beginning to come down. Are you seeing that?
No. I haven't seen it or felt it. I'm looking for it, though.
The cost of living crisis is pushing her into debt.
I've had to do things I wouldn't normally do, like I've had to get credit cards, sometimes payday advance loans, just to be able to make ends meet.
Many Americans are fed up with higher prices, their frustration spilling over on social media.
Yo, this is what $70 gets you at Walmart. That's it, $70.
I make over three times the federal minimum wage, and I cannot afford to live.
In an election year, this spells trouble for the incumbent. Prices are up around 20% since Joe Biden took office.
While the job market is giving Americans the wherewithal to continue spending, they hate inflation.
Sarah Foster is an analyst at Bankrate.
If you're an everyday consumer, you're spending about $1,000 every month on the same goods and services. You know, today that would cost you an extra $208 than it did back then. And that's a huge price increase.
She tells me overall rising wages provide hope, but that hope may not be realized in time to help the president. Once again, here's Bankrate's Sarah Foster.
Prices are slowing at a much faster rate than wages. So at this point, by the end of 2024, is in theory when Americans are on pace to fully make up for the ground that they lost to inflation?
My inherited economy is on the brink. Now our economy is literally the envy of the world.
Joe Biden frequently touts the economy's strength, but it's not holding much sway, at least with voters like Stacey in the pivotal state of Pennsylvania, which could help decide the outcome of the election.
Joe Biden, where are you? Democrats, where are you? I'm a Democrat. I love to vote for them. But the Republicans are speaking volumes right now, and the Democrats are whispering.
U.S. inflation may be moderating, but it's still exerting a powerful force on U.S. politics.
Michelle Fleury there reporting from Pennsylvania. So why is the rate of price increases, known as inflation, proving so difficult to budge from its current level of about 3% to where it's meant to be at 2%? Well, somebody who's involved in those crucial decisions on interest rates is Austin Goolsbee, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, one of 12 reserve banks in the US. He also used to be chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisers for a time under former President Barack Obama. Well, my colleague Rahul Tandon's been speaking to him and asked him why recent inflation has proven so stubborn.
It took longer in 2022, in large measure, I think, because the spillovers of the supply chains. In the economist terms, it was a negative supply shock. And what happened is when you couldn't get computer chips, that affected the car makers. And then when the car makers' costs went up, the people who buy cars and use that for their business, it affected them. And a series of negative events kept happening. We'd have COVID, then we had the price of oil going up and the war in Ukraine erupts. Then we have a series of further negative events. And I think that contributed to a lot of the stickiness. But you've seen in the UK and you've seen in the US over this 1 year arc, inflation rates coming down where the price level is growing slower than it was before.
There is no doubt that that is the case, but they have not come down quickly enough to have interest rate cuts yet. And a lot of people looked at the Fed minutes at the end of last year and thought that we'd have quite a few interest rate cuts this year. We might only have one. We might have none. Is there a danger that the Fed is being too slow here?
There is a danger that it's being too slow. There's a danger it's being too fast. And there's a danger that it's being just right. I mean, the part of our issue is that inflation came down. The inflation rate came down a fair amount last year. And for the first time ever, it came down a lot without a recession. Normally, for inflation to come down like what it did last year requires a massive increase in the unemployment rate and a deep recession.
That doesn't mean we're not going to have one, though, does it?
It doesn't mean we're not going to have one, but we definitely didn't have one in 2023. And then at the beginning of 2024 in the U.S., you saw inflation perk back up. And that is the event that happened that put things onto a slower timetable.
Do you think we will see a rate cut in the U.S. this year?
Look, I'm not a fan of tying our hands of when we are going to get many pieces of information that are critical. I am hopeful that if you start breaking out the components of where inflation has come from, there is the possibility that we can continue to see progress on inflation. And if we see more inflation readings like the one we just got last week, then the appropriate thing will be for rates to come down.
You talked about pain in the economy. We're beginning to see some of that in terms of the job market beginning to cool down. How much more pain can we expect before we get to that 2% inflation figure?
I always say that the job of central banker is to be paranoid about everything. So if you ask me, are you worried about blank, whatever blank you fill in, yes, the answer is I'm worried about that. That's
not it. Worried. What do you think we'll see? Will we see unemployment going to 5%, 6%?
Unemployment staying around where it is now, not a deterioration into a recession while we continue to get inflation down. Up to this point, the Fed has been doing a fabulous job on the maximizing employment side of the mandate and not as great a job on the stabilizing prices side. if we remain as restrictive as we are for too long, we will absolutely have to start thinking about the other side of the mandate too, that the economy will start deteriorating more than we want it to. I want us to strike this balance, and I'm hopeful, but we've hit bumps before, like in January of this year, so we just have to keep plugging.
Austin Goolsbee there, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. We're going to hear now from Edouard Mendy, the Senegalese international and former Chelsea goalkeeper, widely considered to be one of the best keepers in the world. Well, these days he plays in Saudi Arabia, but at the age of 32, he's also thinking about what comes after football. He's become a technology investor and a brand ambassador for Jalea, a fintech company in the Ivory Coast. Well, the BBC's Peter McJobb has been speaking to Mendy and also to his business partner, Matthias Leopoldi.
As a football player, but as an athlete, your life in the game is short. You need, in a short period, to optimize your income. And I was really attracted by the world of startup tech. I really wanted to diversify my assets. And I had these opportunities with some project that really means for me something. That's why I decided to invest and to be a part of those amazing project, which is Jalea.
Jalea is a fintech startup company. Matthias Leopoldi is the director.
Our mission is to help companies grow better. So that means financially helping them to get rid of cash and to borrow better because they are not doing transactions digitally, right? So when you look at Africa, the level of banking, as you know, is quite low. But there's been a mobile money revolution for the past 15 years. So everyone in sub-Saharan Africa is transacting with their mobile phone. And so you can actually provide businesses with a way to access these new technologies so that they can transact better, more efficiently. Send money to their workers if they are unbanked, collect cash, in a better motion so that it's faster, it's safer, and then through all of this data, borrow.
And how crucial was Edward's investment in the growth of Jalea?
He invested his image in the business because I think that's even more precious than money, trust. If you go to Senegal, he can't walk around without being surrounded by people that want to take a selfie, etc. So for us, it was very paramount in the image that we could get because, when you're a fintech and you're working with companies that can be very large, we're working with the ports, we're working with cocoa companies, working with very established business, logistics companies. So when you have this level of responsibility with people's money, the image that, okay, you got this level of people that trust the business, they're like, okay, who am I not to trust this business?
Senegalese international Edouard Mendy and business partner Matthias Leopoldi there talking to Peter McJobb. Well, that is it for this edition of World Business Report. Don't forget our two daily podcasts are always available wherever you usually get your downloads and also on our website at bbcworldservice.com. Thanks for listening.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI. Aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for People.